MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
And it's a Tuesday afternoon. That means we talk to Dr. Ross Walker. Hello, Ross.
G'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise. Let's start with a couple of listener questions. I think I sent one to you, and I've got another one that I haven't sent to you yet, but you're an expert when it comes to these sort of things. This is from Glenn. He said, I recently had a cardiac calcium score test with the results coming back as a score of 83. It was noted that the majority of the calcification is in the LAD. There was definite but mild plaque detected. He said, my GP suggested a stress test just to be safe. What's your opinion on if I should get this stress test?
Well, Glenn's not telling me how old he is.
Uh-huh.
See, I always, when anyone sends a question, is I always need to know how old they are. For example, if Glenn was 70, the average calcium score for a 70-year-old male is 200.
Right.
So I'd completely ignore it. But if he was 50, then I'd say, yes, go ahead and have a stress test just to be sure. But look, let me also make the point here. Calcium is not the problem. It's a marker for fat. So if you imagine a donut where the hole is, that's where the blood's going, but all the fat's building up in the wall like you see in a donut. And as the fat builds up in the wall, the body throws in calcium to act as a scaffold to stop it from breaking down. So the calcium is actually a reparative response to fat, but it's very easy to measure the absolute amount of calcium. So we do a calcium score rather than a fat score. So what I'm trying to do is shrink the fat down, not shrink the calcium down. So I need to know how old Glenn is. If he's 50, then he's got a fair bit of muck for a 50-year-old. If he's 70, forget it and just congratulate him.
Okay. If you're listening this afternoon, Glenn, why don't you drop us an email and let us know your age. Graham says, I read an article from the doctor, Ross Walker, and noticed he mentioned that all males over 50 should have a calcium score.
Yep.
I mentioned this to my doctor as I'm 50 years old, and he said it's probably not necessary due to my cholesterol. But he did give me a referral for a CTCA, right?
Oh, for goodness me, this is complete nonsense.
He said, lastly, he did mention to me that a person died from this test due to an allergic reaction.
Hmm.
Is this true, and are you aware of this incident?
Of course, of course. Look, let me just say something to you. The coronary calcium score and the CTCA, the CT coronary angiogram, are done on exactly the same machine. But the difference is a coronary calcium score is just a snapshot of your artery, just like me taking a photo. You feel absolutely nothing. Whereas the CT angiogram, they inject you with dye, often give you a beta blocker before to slow your heart down. And the difference is that the CT angiogram makes your wallet $500 lighter because both are not covered by Medicare. Typically, with the CT angiogram, it's much more radiation than a coronary calcium score, which isn't much radiation. And so I wait till people hit 50, because there are only three benefits of being over 50. Number one is wisdom. Number two is grandchildren, if you've got them. And number three, you lose the cancer risk from medical radiation. And that's it. So you're not going to get a cancer by having a CT scan 50 plus.
Right.
But if you start radiating people in their 30s and 40s, that's when you may slightly increase their risk for getting a cancer from the radiation. And then finally, you're getting this intravenous injection of an iodine-based dye that you may have an anaphylactic reaction to, or it may even damage your kidneys. So, and then there was a big study in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, I think in 2016, that compared the predictive ability of calcium scoring over a CT angiogram, and the calcium scoring won hands down. So why on earth would you go through this more expensive test that's not a better predictor, that where you potentially are given something you might react badly to, when you can get better information from a calcium score? Now, the rubbish argument used by some of my colleagues is, oh, no, but occasionally you get someone with a zero score who has a high-grade blockage in their arteries. Of course you do. No one's suggesting that the 1 in 500 people who have a zero score who might have a 70, 80% block in one of their arteries, that you're going to pick that up with every test. There is no test in medicine that is 100% accurate. All I'm saying is typically the higher the calcium, the higher the risk. I've seen very occasional people with zero scores go on to have heart attacks, but I see many more people with scores over 100 and especially over 400 who have many more heart attacks than the people in the lower risk range. So all the calcium score is telling you is, A, it's reassuring you don't have big league atherosclerosis, but it's also telling you if it's below 100 that you don't need to be on a damn statin to lower your cholesterol. So the worst calcium score I have, Brent, a 68-year-old man in the fitness industry, doesn't have an ounce of body fat, normal cholesterol, blood pressure, never smoked, not diabetic, and no family history, but he has an elevated lipoprotein, little A. His coronary calcium score was 8,500, and he needed bypass surgery at the age of 68. So, look, the problem is 99.999% repeater of the general public have no understanding of cholesterol, blood pressure, heart disease, calcium scoring, how it all fits in, nor should you. It's not your job. But tragically, 99.9% of the medical profession have no understanding either and give people silly information.
So, what does Graham do? Does Graham go back to his doctor and say, yes, look, I want to have the calcium score test. I don't want to have the CTCA.
I don't need the CTCA. The evidence is overwhelming that the calcium score is a better predictor. And, of course, I understand that it doesn't pick up everything, but it's a much better test and it's a much simpler test and it doesn't involve me being hit with an intravenous injection, and it's less radiation and it's less expensive.
Let me just ask you this question. I can see that the patient would feel a hesitation of going back to their GP and saying, you know, oh, look, I don't think I really want this test. I've been told by somebody else I should have a calcium score test. I can see the hesitation in a patient wanting to say that to their GP.
I get it entirely. But the problem is when you and I were kids, Brent, the God was the doctor. You never disagreed with the doctor. Yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. Anything the doctor said was absolutely right. We live in an information age where you can get any piece of information you like off the internet, not always right. But doctors, it should be two things to people. They should be advisors and servants, and that's it. You've got to take your ego out of it. People come and ask me questions, I answer the questions. And I like people coming with a list of questions so I can give them an intelligent answer to what they're asking me. So if a doctor makes you feel bad about asking a good question or wanting to question why they want to do one test over another, then I go and find another doctor.
Okay, good advice. There was an article actually about this testing, the calcium testing, in one of the weekend papers. It says the nation's leading heart disease institutes have issued a plea for an overhaul of Australia's outdated guidelines on screening for cardiovascular disease. You pick up from where I left off, Ross.
Yeah, well, basically what they're saying, and I interviewed Professor Tom Marwick on my show on Sunday night, about this very subject, because Tom, who wasn't one of the people who criticised me when I first brought this test into Australia 24 years ago, mind you, I've been saying what they're now saying for the last 24 years. This should be used on a much widespread basis. As I always say, if you don't have established heart disease, males at 50, females at 60 should have a coronary calcium score. And now the august bodies around Australia are saying exactly the same thing. It's just taken them 24 years to catch up.
All right. You made this comment before that it wasn't covered by Medicare. Why, yep. Why not? Are we moving towards this changing now so that something like a coronary calcium score can be covered by Medicare or part of it can be covered by Medicare?
I think possibly for people who, in the lower 20% of earners in society, yes, I would give it Medicare coverage. But the problem is a lot of people who get something for nothing don't do anything about it. If you have to pay for something, you tend to be more, well, gee, I better do something about this. And the thing about the calcium score is that if we made it widespread that every person over 50, every male over 50 or female over 60 had a coronary calcium score, it really would do something to the health budget. And I think that the people who are motivated to do something about their health will also be motivated to pay the $200 for the coronary calcium score as opposed to the $1,000 for the CTCA.
Yeah, true. Okay, you want to talk about low back pain. You wrote an article and it says that much research on managing low back pain has been publicised recently. So this article basically says that, what do you call it there? This is an article based on, systemic reviews.
Yeah, your systematic reviews on the subject. So there's been about 350 different reviews over the past 12 months on back pain, because back pain occurs in up to about 20% of the population on a regular basis. And I would say to you, mate, and you and I both know about your back pain, my back pain, that everybody's had a bad episode of back pain at some stage in their life over the age of 50. Mm-hmm. And I don't know anyone who's 60 plus who doesn't have, this medical term for everyone listening, a crappy back or a crappy neck. We all do to some extent because the body is wearing out. One of the great design faults in the body is the neck. It connects the control center up the top to the rest of the body through this narrow little canal. And because we spend a lot of time sitting on our backsides, lying in very comfortable, spongy beds, the back gets twisted and bent, and it's no wonder people get back pain. So the question is, what do you do when you get back pain? And I've got to say, until we brought in these systematic reviews, a lot of people aren't getting the right sort of therapies for their back pain, and there's a lot of different things at work. So, for example, just resting helps to some extent, as does, somebody sent this into my show the other day, a good old hot water bottle or some sort of heat pack on your back when you have acute pain. Give it a few days and it typically settles. But if the pain then starts to go down your leg, what we call sciatica, that's when you need to start thinking about more intensive procedures with a spinal neurosurgeon, getting a microdiscectomy or even a laminectomy or a lumbar fusions. So it's with back pain, it's not the sort of thing that people should put up with for too long. By all means, go to your physio or your osteopath or your chiropractor. I have a treatment every week called MedKey therapy, which is a handheld electromagnetic device that gets into the areas and frees up my back so I don't have chronic back pain because I prevent it. I have a regular massage as well. All of these things are things that people should do whatever they can afford and whatever they can keep doing to keep them out of pain. But there are so many things you can do. The important thing is to do something, not just to put up with the pain, because it can be, as you well know, absolutely disabling.
Yep, for sure. There's a radical new theory that wrinkles actually cause aging rather than aging causing wrinkles. I always thought it was that aging causes wrinkles.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'll ask you a question, my friend. Trivial Pursuit question. What is the biggest organ in the body?
The skin.
Yeah, that is the right answer if you're playing Trivial Pursuit, but it's actually the wrong answer. The biggest organ in the body is the endothelium, which is a single layer of cells that lines every blood vessel in the body. It's about 6 tennis courts worth. But the skin comes in number 2. And so, therefore, if the skin gets disordered, i.e. gets wrinkled, then your skin ain't working properly. So think of it logically. You have these things called skin stem cells that every month or so get a signal to say, okay, it's time you made some new skin. So the stem cell divides into 2 cells. One is an ongoing stem cell. The other one's a daughter cell that becomes skin. But as you get older, those stem cells don't work as well, and often they become what we call senescent or zombie cells that basically just wander around the body, not doing anything but just ripping out all the chemicals from good, healthy young cells. So they basically steal nutrients and also secrete things called inflammatory cytokines that inflames the body. So as you get more wrinkled, you get more of these senescent stem cells, which are causing more of the, which are promoting aging and damaging the other organs in your body and the other cells in your body. So what they're saying is it's really important as you get older to look after your skin and to try and reduce the amount of wrinkles you have. So anything you can do that's going to reduce your wrinkles. And what's the best advice I can give anyone? We live in the skin cancer capital of the world, Brent. Keep out of the sun. Slip,
yeah.
Slop, slap. Don't smoke cigarettes. That makes you wrinkled. Don't drink alcohol too much. That makes you wrinkled. So don't use illegal drugs. Look at the Rolling Stones, for goodness sake. I'm not suggesting they've ever used an illegal drug, but they're pretty wrinkled people. So I'm just saying that the more wrinkles you have, the more senescent stem cells you have, and the worse it is for your body.
Cancer mystery, as cases rise among younger people around the world. They're saying the number of people under 50 with cancer is increasing in many countries.
Yeah, and this is the disturbing, and this comes from many, many people studied to show that the increase in cancer over the last 3 decades in people below 50 is 22%. Wait for this, for bowel cancer, it's 50%. So the big question is, why? Well, our genes haven't changed, so it can't be a genetic thing. But what has changed over the last 3 decades, I believe, is we've been exposed to so many more synthetic chemicals, and also the obesity rates are going through the roof. And so when you eat a lot of processed packaged muck masquerading as food when you're exposed to all of these environmental pollutants. All of these things put on weight, and so with the weight you're secreting this thing called insulin-like growth factor, which also increases tumour rates as well, and all of these things pulverise your gut bacteria, gets back to the old gut microbiome that you and I have spoken about for years, and that also can put these abnormal chemicals into your bloodstream that can increase your cancer risk.
This is not good. Drinking alcohol brings no health benefits whatsoever. Now, this is a study has looked at, well, literally hundreds of other studies, because there's been many that have said, you know, X amount of alcohol is good for you. But all of a sudden, we're now told that drinking alcohol brings absolutely no health benefits whatsoever. And I'm glad we don't live in Canada.
Yeah, well, yeah, Canada, where they say the only healthy intake of alcohol is none or two per week.
Yeah.
And as you say, most Australians spill that amount per day.
Yes.
And we're talking about a study, 107 studies, including 5 million people from multiple countries, and found that, for example, a lot of the studies that say there's a benefit from alcohol have just brought in people who used to be drinkers and now they're non-drinkers. And so they're not putting them in the same, they're putting them in the same category as lifelong abstainers. And in fact, the people who were prior drinkers who stopped drinking had a 22% increased risk of death compared with the abstainers. But when you look at the actual statistics they're quoting here, it's if you consistently drink four or more glasses per day as a woman, you increase your death risk by about 60%. If you do that as a male, you increase your death risk about 35%. But below that, they're saying there is no benefit or detriment. Now, you and I have spoken for years about this, and I've been saying for a long time, I think the evidence for a couple of glasses of red wine per day reducing some forms of cardiovascular disease is reasonable. And I would never, ever, Brent, suggest to anyone that as part of their health regimen that they start drinking if they are non-drinkers. My message is if you're having four or five drinks a day, pull it back to two drinks a day. That is still doable. If you say to someone who's drinking four or five drinks a day, stop drinking, they're probably not going to do it. So I think a healthy message is that a couple of drinks a day. And there are two major studies that have been done from Europe, not the American studies, which most of these studies include, American and Canadian studies, where they combine drinking with a crappy diet. When you eat a better Mediterranean-style diet, the two of these major studies have shown a 50% reduction in heart disease and cancer by adding a couple of glasses, small glasses of red wine to the meal. Now, that's the only studies I can quote that show a significant benefit. Although there was a fellow, Professor Leon Simons, who's one of Australia's cholesterol experts, did a thing called the Dubbo Heart Study in older people and found in those group of people, those who had one or two drinks a day, whether it was wine, beer or spirits, still had a modest health benefit, not major.
What role does alcohol play, and we're talking a moderate consumption of alcohol here, what role does alcohol play in inflammation in the body?
I think in low levels, not much at all. I don't think it's anti-inflammatory. But again, if you're taking consistently four or five, you're affecting your immune system. The immune cells don't work as well, and so inflammation can take over. So certainly, anyone who drinks more than three drinks a day on a regular basis is in trouble.
Well, I've got to say, from someone that hasn't had a drink in nearly 3 months now, can I tell you, they say give up alcohol and you'll feel so much better. You'll sleep better, you'll lose weight, your skin will be better, and, you know, the list goes on. Bunkum. Bunkum. You don't sleep better, you don't lose weight, and I don't think you feel much better either.
No, but can I say, mate, that is your own experience.
Of course it is, yes.
Some people, I have a lot of people that say, oh, look, I was having three or four drinks a day, I've given it up, now I am sleeping so much better and I do feel better. So I think this is the problem. You never take your experience and extrapolate it. That's just an anecdote. You've got to look at clinical trials where they've looked at a whole lot of people over a period of time.
Heart disease. Nearly half of adults over 40 have a hidden condition. What's the hidden condition?
Well, the hidden condition is what we call atherosclerosis. So can I say everybody over the age of 30 has a degree of atherosclerosis? So if I took someone's arteries out and had a look at them under a microscope, and I wouldn't because it creates a shocking mess on the floor, but what you will see a bit of fat in almost everyone's arteries. But this was a study where they did the CTCA that we were talking about before and found that below the age of 40, still 46% had some detectable degree of muck in their arteries. 10% had some minor blockages. Some occasional people had major blockages. And the other 36%. So of the 46%, 10 of 46 minor blockages, 36 of 46 no blockages but a lot of calcium.
Is there a medication you can take or something you can take that can help clear up your arteries, get rid of some of that muck or not?
Absolutely, but there's not a medication. It's the whole process. And so I say to all my patients, 80% of your management's got nothing to do with damn doctors or pills. It's how you look after yourself. The five keys, I'll say them very quickly. No addictions, good sleep, good eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours of exercise, and most importantly, happiness. That's 80%. Then if you have significant atherosclerosis, a statin, blood pressure treatment, treatment of your diabetes, all of those things helps. Blood thinners, they will help. And then finally, all the supplements I talk about, the BPF 100 or the BJE 100 from the bergamot plant, the ubiquinol, the vitamin K2, the magnesium orotate, and the chiolic garlic, all of those things combined help suck the fat out of your arteries.
Okay. That's us done and dusted for another week. It's always great to catch up with you. Thank you for your time, mate.
Good on you, mate.
Talk to you next week. That is Dr. Ross Walker. Yeah. Actually, I don't know whether we will talk to him next week because it's Anzac Day, isn't it? Next Tuesday? I think it's Anzac Day next Tuesday. Anyway, I'm sure we'll catch up with him one day next week. And if you've got any questions for the good doctor, what you need to do is write them out, send them to us via email. And then what I do is send them to him. And as you heard today, he'll answer those questions for you on the radio.